The panel, number 36. If you want to be number 36, you're in the right place. Planting the seeds of the gospel in the international church, a rich background of diversity. I am the panel moderator. I'm Tricia Ormsby, and I forgot as I was turning in the information to say who I was. I teach at BYU. I'm in the Family Sciences Department. And I think we'll have a real interesting discussion today. If you read the abstract in the program, you'll see we're talking about the church and the diversity of culture in different areas of the world. And one of the temptations in putting this panel together, I think, was to get someone from every part of the world, which would have kind of diluted it. So I hope that you enjoy the parts of the world that we're going to be talking about today, particularly Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and some of the impacts that culture has on church participation there. Just to give you an idea of who we're talking about in the church, as far as membership goes, there are over 7 million members of the church worldwide. 7,301,000 as of a couple months ago. And 4 million, a little bit over 4 million, are in the United States and Canada. Now, next to that, in Latin America, we have almost 2 million members. That includes the Caribbean, Central America, Mexico, and South America. So that's a very substantial number. In Asia, we have over 400,000 members. In Africa, we have a fast-rising 44,000 members, and the number is increasing by leaps and bounds there. And so we have within this combination of Africa, Asia, and Central America, we have some areas where the church is very well established, like in Central and South America, and places where the church is just growing. So I think we'll be able to get a feeling of some of the ways that the church does grow and progress. Now, one of the things that I think is crucial about discussing the integration of members of the church from all around the world is the fact that we are a church that intends to proclaim the gospel worldwide. And there are a lot of different kinds of people in the world with various backgrounds and beliefs about things and feelings about life. And there is a great opportunity to add richness and diversity to the gospel by truly incorporating people from different parts of the world into the gospel. If any of you read Dale LeBaron, had an article in last month's Insight of talking about the new members of the church that were coming in, that were joining the church from Africa. And there was an interesting story, I thought, about a man who had a dream about someone playing the piano on only the white keys. And it didn't sound very good. And then he visualized it with the black keys being played in, and he realized the church needed both white and black members to make harmony. And I think we can even expand that farther to say that we need all different kinds of not only pianos with black and white keys, but different kinds of instruments to add in, too, to make really full harmony in the gospel. They all have something to add. I'd just like to read to you, as we start here, some questions that John Carmack presented at a talk that he gave a couple years ago on cultural diversity in the church. Let's see if I can get the first part. To decide, and this is his quote, to decide what part of the church is basic and necessary rather than merely interesting but superfluous promises to be a challenge in the decades ahead. How we face the great hurdles of prejudice and ignorance in coming to grips with our proud and well-deserved claim of being a worldwide church will largely determine whether our appeal will remain broad, our mission clear, and our drive and energy to accomplish that mission unabated. In addition to the challenge of maintaining energy and broad appeal, there is also the challenge of maintaining the essential characteristics of the restored gospel of Jesus Christ. Will cultural differences swallow the basic truths of the gospel? Will the church insist on exporting Americanism as if it were one of the basic gospel principles? And so on. I think we can get the flavor from that, some of the ideas that we're going to be talking about today. I think that we couldn't get people better prepared to share experiences with us than the people we have here sitting on the panel. I feel very indebted to them and very grateful that they're spending some time with us today. I'd like to give you a brief introduction to them and to their backgrounds before they speak, and I'm sure as they speak you'll understand some more about their experience in the church and their great and rich background. The first person I am particularly indebted to is Dr. Stephen Hatch. Now, if you notice your program, it says Bay Hutchings on the program. Well, Bay Hutchings went in for emergency surgery last week, and he was the first mission president to Zaire. But Dr. Hatch was the second. So we still have, and he's also a physician. So everything else holds true on that, except for you substitute second for first and change Stephen Hatch instead of Bay Hutchings. And I really appreciate him coming at short notice. He has had much experience in the church, including serving a French mission, being a bishop on the High Council, and has presided over three missions, Belgium, Brussels, the Mascarene Islands, and I hope he tells us where those are, and the Zaire Kinshasa mission. This is the most recent place where he served. And he, as I said, is a medical doctor. The next person on our program is Malin Jackson, who is a former mission president to Taiwan. And I actually arrived in Taiwan as a missionary 2 days after he left. So I don't know. Unfortunately, our paths didn't cross then, but they have crossed since, and I've been really glad for that. He has had many, many experiences in Asia, has recently worked for several years in a yacht building plant in Xiamen, China, and also in a dairy business in Guangzhou, China, and has had very immense amounts of contact with Chinese people and opportunities to talk about the church and religion, and has some fabulous experiences. Yeah, he's the current director of the Center for International Studies at Utah Valley Community College and still continues to work on a lot of international projects. Luis Espinosa is over here on the end. And Luis is Chilean. He was born and raised in Chile and has been in the United States though for many years, so we can claim him too. And he is the coordinator for Latin American Affairs, the Benson Agriculture and Food Institute at BYU. And he has been there for 12 years, and this is basically a rural development position where he has spent 8 of those years in the field. So he has been working in particularly Mexico, Guatemala, also Bolivia, and rural development projects. So again, lots of opportunities to visit with people and understand their culture and their concerns, and particularly those of members of the church. So without any more introduction on my part, I'd like to have our panelists have a chance to share some of their thoughts with you. The way we'll run the panel today is each of the panelists will have the opportunity to share some remarks with you, and then at the end we'll open it for questions. And so if you have questions for specific people or questions for you'd like all the panelists to respond to, feel free to jot them down, and then we'll go ahead and have questions at the end after the panelists have presented. Let's see, Malin, would you like to go first? And
I'll do it.
Okay, and after that, Dr. Hatch and Luis, would that work out?
Okay. Okay, and I'll get some water for everybody.
As I looked, we'll try with it. As I looked at the other two panelists, I noticed that they had these very impressive-looking folders with them. And I'm sure that Tricia noticed that and is wondering if I'm really prepared.
I offered you my folder, so you can.
The Far East has very much been my life, China particularly, China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, since 1955. And during those years, I have been totally impressed with what the church is doing in the Far Eastern countries. I will share with you some of my experiences in this development. But first, let me share with you a little story that I hope doesn't fit too much anymore. I went originally to Japan as a missionary. At that time, all of the Far East was one mission. That was 1955. I arrived in Japan in August of 1955, having already been instructed that I would go on to Hong Kong. The Japan mission was being divided into two missions, a Northern Far East mission and a Southern Far East mission. When we look at the number of missions in the Far East now, it's hard to comprehend that just 35 years ago, there was only one mission in all of that area. Shortly after I arrived in Hong Kong, the second group of missionaries arrived, and among them was a young man from Idaho. I got to know him quite well, very quickly. There weren't many of us then. And we were sharing stories about our interest in the Far East and our call to the Far East as missionaries. And he said, I must share with you my experience. His family were originally from Germany. He spoke German, was very interested in going to Germany on a mission. He was working away from home and had left instructions with his grandmother, who lived at home with them, to call him as soon as the mission call came so he would know where he was assigned. A couple of days later, after he had given her that instruction, the call came. And she was very apologetic on the telephone. She said, I know you wanted to serve a foreign mission, but you'll be here in the U.S. He said, well, okay, but where am I going? He said, you're going to serve in southern Florida. So the rest of the day, he was thinking about his service in southern Florida. He came home, took the call, went up to his bedroom to read it, and it stated that he was called to the Southern Far East Mission with headquarters in Hong Kong. Now, 35 years ago, I'm afraid there was a lot of that. As far as we could think, south and east was southern Florida. I have been involved with China, with the church, academically, business, banking, doing research in the Far East for these 35 years. And I am excited about the changes I see taking place. When we arrived in Hong Kong in 1955, there were 3 members of the church in that colony. Missionaries from our church had been there briefly in 1949. At that time, the communist government was moving towards Hong Kong. They did eventually take Canton, just a few hours up the Pearl River from Hong Kong. Missionaries were withdrawn from that colony. Missionaries had attempted to work in the same colony in 1852. They stayed there 3 months. The land of China was dedicated for missionary work in 1920. 1852, the Taiping Rebellion was ravaging China. More than 30 million people may have been killed during that time, either killed in the rebellion or died from starvation. 1920, the Communist Party was founded about that time, and again, China was being ravaged by war. 1949, I've mentioned the Communist government overran China, the Nationalist government withdrawing to Taiwan. So 1955, the church was established to stay on the mainland of China. I would like to address also what you asked us to talk about, Tricia. And I will speak mostly about the Chinese people because my experience in Japan, Korea have been very brief. But I do believe what I will say is also representative of those countries in many ways. Christianity is not new in China, at least in our terms of history. The first Christian missionary went to China, at least from a stele, a stone monument uncovered by a group of Catholic missionaries in Xi'an in northwest China in 1627. The stele told the story of a Christian missionary in China in 625 AD. Needless to say, he wasn't Mormon. He was a Nestorian from Persia. But the church did grow. That was during the Tang Dynasty. The Tang rulers were very interested in religion and very tolerant of foreign missionaries. Later, other groups went into China. The Catholics were very strong with their missionary effort in China, establishing missions throughout the whole country, even at times when foreigners were not welcome in any part of China. They established missions in Lhasa, in Tibet. They established missions in far west Xinjiang province and in the north in Xi'an. The Protestants came to China much later. The first Protestant missionary arrived there in 1805, working for the East India Trading Company, Robert Morrison, who labored for 40 years as a missionary in China and baptized one person. But he translated the Bible. He established Christian schools, and the foundation was laid. In those early years, the religions, we may call them that in China, the cultural differences between the Chinese and the West were such that it was very difficult for these missionaries. Nonetheless, they persevered. And with the establishment of Western economic strongholds in China, the Christian schools became more common. The missionaries, with the aid of gunboats, unfortunately at times, were able to establish their missions. The China Inland Mission, established in the 1860s, went throughout all of China, often again riding aboard these gunboats, supported by the Western mercantile interests. And they were effective in spreading Protestantism through China. I read the history of that mission and their missionaries, and their lot was very difficult. The Buddhists were strong in China. The Taoist belief still prevailed throughout the country. Other minor religious groups in various provinces also tended to propagate Chinese beliefs and to actually fight against the Westerners. Perhaps the most destructive effort to rid China of the foreigners, whom the Chinese did not trust, was the Boxer Rebellion, which began in 1898. The missionaries were hunted down and killed. The effort was to rid China of all foreigners. There were stories rampant throughout the country of things that the foreign missionaries did to destroy the culture. One story that was promulgated in 1898 in Beijing said that those compassionate Christian nuns who went around the streets of Beijing early each morning and brought the abandoned children back to their orphanage were really gathering up these children. They were killed inside the orphanage, and their eyes were used to make strange Western concoctions to heal the sick among the foreigners who were not accustomed to living in China. They were afraid of the foreigners, and the foreigner in the Far East was not a welcome visitor. As I walk on the streets of Canton today, or even in Hong Kong, I still hear people, mostly young people now, as they see me on the streets, referring to me as a Guailo. Now, you probably know what a Guailo means, Tricia. A foreign devil. The first Western visitors in mass to China, after the Persians, the Arabians went there, were from Europe. Many of them were Dutch. Many of them had red hair and blue eyes. You don't see many Chinese with red hair and blue eyes. Matter of fact, as you walk into their temples and see their depiction of hell, the devils are painted with red hair and blue eyes. Also, the early foreigners in China were not welcome because of their pursuits of trade at any cost. The West found that China had many things that we could use. Silk, porcelains, and later tea, which the British hauled out by the millions of tons before they learned how to raise it themselves in India. To balance the trade, the foreigners used opium. So hundreds of millions of dollars of opium were taken to China, and not forced on the people. There was a leisured class who had the money and the time to use opium. Very destructive to developments in China. So the Westerners just were not welcome. And many emperors in Beijing wrote edicts declaring the Westerners persona non grata in the Celestial Empire. The opium trade was finally put to test and for a time stopped in 1839 when the emperor sent a commissioner, Commissioner Lin, to Canton, where they destroyed about $25 million worth of opium and once again drove the foreigners out. But this precipitated the Opium War, which brought the British Navy up the Pearl River. They blew down the walls of the city. They won the war, and Hong Kong was one of the reparations for that war. Later, there followed 141 so-called treaty ports. Originally, these were on the coast. But these ports were extended inland. They were basically foreign enclaves within China's territory, not subject to Chinese law, ruled by the foreigners. This is where the missionaries lived, where they were protected, again by the gunboats. Unfortunately, the missionaries were not necessarily called imperialists, as the others were who took the territory, but as we read the history of that period, they were called the running dogs of imperialism. It was not surprising when the communists took power, not only for communist beliefs, but because of the long-standing connection between that the missionaries were expelled from China. In Korea, the Christian missionaries have had a much better experience. They've been well received in that country, at least in my experience. The Koreans are a much gentler people and did not have to undergo the difficulties that the Chinese did in dealing with the foreign opium merchants and others who were in China only to do business. Japan also struggled in allowing the Christian missionary to come into their country. Finally, Dewey went in with his Ramada and opened the doors of the of China in the Japan in the mid-19th century to the businessman and the missionary alike. It was a difficult time. Of course, in Japan and Korea, following the Second World War, the servicemen had an important influence on what happened there, and of course among them there were many of the LDS servicemen. And so the church gained a strong foothold. And as we look at Japan and Korea today, the church is very, very strong in those places. Taiwan, the early church effort there was also begun in part by the businessman, but very much by the servicemen. In Hong Kong, I've talked of the early beginnings of the church there. But how do these people receive the church? Does their culture interfere with understanding and accepting the gospel of Jesus Christ? It has been my experience, and again primarily in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and China, that since the founding of the church there, the young people especially have been so indoctrinated with Western ideas that they are quite receptive to the gospel. The older people sit in their ways in Buddhism, other Oriental religions. It has been more difficult for them. But nonetheless, as we see the growth in those countries, I am impressed more with the support of their cultures for receiving, believing, and living the gospel than any detriment that may come from their traditional religion or cultural beliefs. Having said that, let me share just a few experiences. When we arrived in Hong Kong in 1955, as I mentioned, there were three members we could find from earlier efforts, one American working at the consulate. I don't know the exact membership in Hong Kong today, but as you go there and as you attend any of the wards, as you meet with the leaders and see their strength, and as we continue to see the success of the missionaries there, it's impressive. And to me, again, indicates the receptiveness of the Chinese people especially and the Oriental people generally to the gospel and the principles of the gospel. The church is very strong in Hong Kong and growing very rapidly. In Taiwan, there's a temple in Taipei now. The leadership of the church is very strong. We have the same difficulties with inactivity, but I don't see it being very different than from what I see in this country. As a matter of fact, the activity generally I can favorably compare with Utah, even though our experience has been much longer, and would like to think that the Western receptiveness to Christian principles is much more ready. I have seen, especially in recent years, and I lived on the Chinese mainland, was involved in business there for about 6 years, returned home just over a year ago. The church direction for members going to China is very specific, that we do not claim to represent the church, that we do not openly proselyte. However, if we're asked by the people there to teach them, asked about the gospel, then we should, of course, share it. As you're probably aware, the Chinese culture has been very severely battered by the communist government rule in China. Nonetheless, I'm impressed that those people converted to Christianity by the efforts of the Catholic and Protestant missionaries remain very faithful to their beliefs. I don't think anyone knows what the membership of the Christian churches in China might be at this time, but Christians I've talked with in China who are very in the Christian movement there, and it is strong, report that there are over 100 million practicing Christians in China today. I lived in South China for the 6 years I was there. In Fujian province, which is just across from Taiwan, there were approximately 2.5 million Christians attending various meetings there, still strong in their belief. In the province just to the north, about 7.5 million practicing Christians. And these are strong people. They're good people. Some of them, from families 3 and 4 generations of Christian believers. I was especially impressed in talking with them as to the purity of their beliefs now. Christian missionaries have not been there for more than 40 years. These people have been dependent primarily upon their own study and use of the Bible. I attended meetings in South China and was very impressed that it could have been a Mormon chapel, a Mormon meeting. My experiences with individuals, and again to express how the spiritual opportunity and the desire for a spiritual experience, a spiritual belief, overcomes their cultural differences, overcomes even threats of a government that has attempted to destroy Christianity. I saw it in so many lives. One story I first read in a book entitled China Alive in the Bitter Sea, and I've experienced the same type of situation many times since then. The author of that book was in China about 1980 as a correspondent for the New York Times. He was invited to the home of a very high official in the government, a Communist Party member, a very powerful member. When he went to the home, his first surprise was to find that a maid opened the door. In a communist society, he had assumed this wasn't the practice. But when he walked into the study, the woman was sitting at a desk reading. And as he walked up to her to greet her, he discovered it was the Bible that she was reading. I remember experiences like this on many occasions. A top party official I worked with in South China, a man who had not had a religious background, but who was quite powerful in the Communist Party, came to me one day and said, I know that you're a Mormon. He said, I don't know much about the Mormons. I know that you believe in Christ. And you probably are concerned that your main contact here is a communist. He says, but I'm not. He said, just because I'm a member of the Communist Party doesn't mean I'm a communist. He asked for a copy of the Book of Mormon, and it made a very important difference in this man's life. But this happened many times in my association with those people. Buddhism is reviving in parts of China again. The government has allocated funds to refurbish the temples that the Red Guards destroyed. But again, in conversation with these people, the young people, as they go back to those temples, they know that there is a spiritual element missing in their lives. And they're trying to find something to fill that. And I do not recall an occasion during the 6 years I was involved on the Chinese mainland that as I opened a conversation, or as they came to me, and many times they would, usually first to practice English, but then to find out about Western culture, and inevitably we would talk about religion. They were very receptive. It was not possible to baptize these people. The church is instructed that we shouldn't do that in China. So we have a better way. They come here to school. And I can say, with one exception, the people I have met from China, I've got to know, I've had time with, have been baptized. Some have gone back to China. And life may be difficult for them, but I believe that, especially farther away from Beijing, they will be able to begin nuclei of the church in that country. The Confucianist belief and Taoism in China and throughout the Far East has been important. And the Chinese culture and religious beliefs have been the base for much of what has developed in other parts of the Far East, in Japan, in Korea, Southeast Asia. People have asked me, is Confucianism still alive in China? It is, barely. Those who were trained in the Confucius school of thought, most of them are very old or have already died. But I did have occasion to meet many of these people in Hong Kong and in Taiwan. And I have deep respect for Confucianism. It was an important element in the building of China. But just one quick experience. One of my most loved friends in all the world lives in Canton. He's 86 years old. He is a Confucian scholar in every sense of the word, educated in the traditional school, and has maintained that way of life and those beliefs, despite all of the opposition he's had from the government and the changes in China. I met the man when I hired him to teach my children while we were living in China. But I soon found that he was learning much more than my boys were. Now, it wasn't his fault that my boys weren't learning. But as he taught them Chinese painting, the Chinese language, traditional Chinese values, something about Confucianism, he was constantly questioning them about their beliefs. And many days, the Book of Mormon was laid out on the table with the Bible rather than the Chinese texts. I taught this man some, but it really wasn't necessary to teach too much because he understood it. As he read the Bible, as he read the Book of Mormon, he said, I know this. These are eternal principles that we all know if we are seeking truth. He said, it verifies what I have felt in my heart. He knew these things and he believed them. He accepted them. I don't know if it's a matter of conversion. I think he was already converted. It was a matter of reinforcement of what he knew to be true. We could not hold open church meetings, but we did have our family church meetings in our home. He insisted on coming. I checked with the officials and they said, well, if he wants to come, that's fine. Then he began bringing other people. And as I taught them, he would stop me and say, now let me tell them what you said. It was in Chinese, and I was trying hard, but as I listened to him explain it, he understood it perfectly. And I would maintain this was through his Confucian training, the discipline of the Confucian philosophy, but also the truths that he had learned, and it had developed a hunger within this man to know much more. And he and I chuckled. He reminded me of a statement I had heard in the 50s. Someone told me that Confucius had taught truths, but on one day he was asked, well, you've told us a lot about earth, now what about heaven? And his answer was, Mei ji song, yin ji sei. He says, not understanding this life very well, how can we go on and talk about heaven? Now, if he'd only understood, that would help him better understand this life. But that was his statement, and this man reminded me of that. And he said, this answers all of those questions, and he was ready to receive them. I had experience with many people, got what, 2 minutes left? Who had belonged to other Christian denominations in China. But again, to express what I mentioned earlier about these groups in China having been dependent only on the Bible and their prayers to find the truth over these last 4 decades, they have, if they have been sincere, and so many of them have, they have come to understand the gospel almost in its fullness. I stopped one day in Xiamen at a little antique shop. It was illegal. The government says the private individuals can't sell antiques in China, but this man just had a few little odds and ends in a display case out on the sidewalk. I went in, we talked a while, and I went away with an old clock, which I got all the way to Utah with. And I hang it on my wall as a memory of that experience, as a reminder of that experience. But as I was leaving, and this was when this particular city, Xiamen, had just been opened for the foreigners to come in, he very quietly said, could you come back tonight and meet my family? We want to talk with you. And I said, I'd be happy to. And he said, be sure it's after dark. People were watching. It wasn't popular to have a foreign friend at that time. I went back that evening, and he took me upstairs above his shop in a tiny little room, sat down at a table, met his wife and 2 daughters. And then he brought from a lock case on the side of his room something wrapped in black velvet, laid it down on the table, opened it, and with tears in his eyes said, do you know what this is? Do you know what this is? It was the Bible. I said, yes, I know the Bible. He said, could you stay tonight and teach us more about the Bible? He said, we haven't had a teacher for so many years. And so we talked way after midnight that night, and I went back occasionally as I could, as he dared have me come. But his understanding of the gospel was almost pure, and it was from the Bible and from their own prayers. They had a background of traditional Chinese beliefs before he had heard about Christianity. He had taught his daughters, whom he did not dare to allow to go to a Christian church and be openly observed there by the Communist Party officials. But through all of that, the important influence in his own life was the spirit, he said, within himself. His daughter has come to the U.S. now. She's been baptized. And he's just begging to come. We can't get a visa for him to come. I could repeat this story many times. And people who have grown up in traditional Chinese homes others who have grown up in Christian homes, others who have grown up like this man. He spent 10 years in prison because he was a businessman and a Christian. But all of these people, again, when they hear the gospel, when they get a copy of the Book of Mormon, recognize it. And I don't remember one in China, on the mainland, that rejected these conversations. To the contrary, they accepted it. They begged for it. And as I've mentioned, when they come here, they are readily baptized. I had a conversation, if you don't mind my mentioning it generically, just as the meeting began, with a very dear friend whose husband served his mission in Taiwan. A few months ago, he told me that he had made the acquaintance of a man who was the Secretary General of a Christian organization in China. All China. But I can't remember exactly either. China is concerned about this. Just before I left China, Billy Graham was there. And he had a meeting with Liu Peng, whom we've all come to fear, I guess, after the Tiananmen massacre. But in that conversation with Billy Graham, Liu Peng made the statement, and it was printed in the Chinese newspaper, that we have made important strides economically, politically, and socially, but we are missing the spiritual element in our development. We need it. And this man came to the United States specifically to study religion and to find the religion for China. He will go back to China soon. The other man, I think, was an aide with him to assist with this study. All right. The student has been baptized, will go back to China. The secretary felt that perhaps he could do more, and I agree, for the church in China without having become a formal member. So these people, despite the impact that communism must have had on their lives, the threat of even daring to believe in Christianity, are flocking to the church, literally begging to know more about the restored gospel. The Buddhists, young children in the far back country of China, who've grown up in homes that have remained Buddhist, are looking for spiritual truth and are so receptive when we share it with them. So China is just waiting for us. Students are returning. General authorities are going there and have opened doors. The day is coming. The challenge there is not cultural difference, communist ideology. The challenge there is for us to be ready to teach 1.3 billion people when China opens. Thank you very much.
My involvement with the international mission has been rather limited in extent of time, and it's extended over many years. And I thought perhaps a brief description of that would be an introduction to the thoughts that I've developed about the challenge the church faces in taking the gospel to the world. It was 53 years ago, as a teenager, between my pre-medical and medical school studies, I served in the French mission. At that time, there was only one French-speaking mission in Europe. It included the francophone parts of Belgium and Switzerland and all of France. My assignment as a young man took me to all three countries. And while there were distinct differences among them, in all three the church was little known, poorly understood, and faced with powerful religious control over the people. In Belgium and France, it was Catholic control largely, and in Switzerland, there was a strong Protestant influence. Investigators at that time in Belgium were likely to be faced with loss of their job and family opposition. Already in France by that time, the common finding was indifference. Je suis catholique, mais non pratiquant. The fledgling church in Belgium included a few strong leaders, three little tiny chapels, one in Liège, one in Herstal. Some of the leaders emigrated to the United States. In French-speaking Switzerland, there are only a few small branches, only one in the large cities such as Geneva or Lausanne. Each branch was supported by a few dedicated families. These branches were housed in rented halls or apartments. At that time, I recall no native Melchizedek priesthood holders in all of France. Branches were small and fragile, and misunderstandings and opposition among the member families were common and resulted in much disruption in the growth of the church. The missionaries of that period came with much less preparation than they do today. Rules and regulations were much less well-defined. Supervision and discipline were loose. The proselyting plan revolved around several tracts, brochures, and the Book of Mormon was not at all uniform, and converts to the church were very few and far between. World War II brought a halt to the progress. The missionaries were called home, the missions were closed, and the work stopped. Now skip 43 years. In 1980, and in the interim, I was heavily involved in medical practice. My wife and I returned to Belgium to preside over the mission in Belgium and France. And at that time, there were already four Francophone missions. There were three stakes. And although the progress was still very slow, it was steady. And we were pleased to find that the Lord had prepared many young, vigorous native leaders to move the church work forward. There were also many third-generation members of the church with many strong families. There had begun to be missionaries from there to other parts of the world. The strength of the religious persecution which I'd seen as a young man had been broken mostly by indifference related to the ease of life attained in those countries and the feeling, why do we need God? While we were there, two more stakes were organized. The growth and progress of the international church in England and Europe is beginning to parallel that of the United States. In 1985 to 87, we were called to serve and preside in the Indian Ocean on Mauritius and Reunion Islands. From 1988 to 1990, this year, we served in the newly organized mission in Zaire, the old Belgian Congo in West Central Africa. Mauritius is a little island, and you ask where? About 1,100 miles east of Africa, 2,500 miles south of India, and 2,000 to 3,000 miles west of Australia in the Indian Ocean. It's still third world by health and standards of living measures. It has a mixed population with East Indian, Hindu, African Creole, Chinese, with a few European whites, mostly French and English. Zaire, on the other hand, is definitely a fourth world country, if we can use that term. Most are black, but are divided into over 200 tribes with fierce rivalries and loyalties. Zaire was controlled and colonized by the Belgians, Christian missionaries have been there for over a century, and they've done a great work. They've brought education, schools. They brought medical care. The level of Bible scholarship is high. There's a tremendous subjection of women, and in many cases still are treated as chattel. Zaire was granted independence in the 60s and has been dominated by a strong black dictator president for about 30 years. The standard of living has deteriorated every year since. Unemployment is extremely high. Wages are low for those who do find work. The cost of living is shot up every year with over 100% inflation annually. Many can afford only one meal a day. The mission in Zaire is barely 3 years old. While we presided in Belgium, we were aware of students who came to Europe, to Belgium and France from Africa, and among them were several Zairians. They were very receptive. I recall that a young man in Brussels was baptized. His name is complicated, the King of Nikita Bungibui, so he was called Bob. But he was converted, and after a year, he was sent to England as a full-time missionary. By the time we arrived there, he was a branch president. Also, the religious people of Zaire had received some church literature, and they had organized groups called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in which they studied the Book of Mormon. However, those groups were very difficult because they had incorporated elements of the restored gospel with their traditional religion. When we got there, there were two missionary couples. One in Kinshasa, the capital city of about 6 million people. There were two branches of the church presided over by, one was an expatriate in the United States Embassy and the other was this Bob. And in a city 1,200 miles away of about 500,000 population called Lubumbashi, there was one missionary couple and one branch of the church. The mission in Zaire is barely 3 years old. Finding people to teach is no problem. Large numbers want to be taught the gospel and readily understand and accept. The problem is identifying those who want to be taught and joined for the right reasons, and who will become assets to the growth of the church there. These experiences have opened our eyes to some of the challenges the church faces in the third and fourth world countries. Zaire, with its 60 million, becomes minuscule compared with the billions in the rest of Africa, Eastern Europe, Asia, China, Japan, India. Our experience there has helped us realize that without careful monitoring, without careful supervision, without proper leadership training, we'll be engulfed And the expression that President Morrison used, "Wawa, West Africa wins again," will continue. It's essential that we, the church, and the church is exerting great efforts in this direction, I believe, appreciate the challenges. And I've listed a few here, the challenges in that we saw: missionary and leadership training manpower. Now, the new president has two couples in Kinshasa, and I remind you, some 6 million people, and now there are 9 branches. In Lubumbashi, he has 2 couples, and that one branch has grown to 5 branches with 4 locations. Missionary and leadership training manpower. There are not enough couples available, particularly Francophone couples, who are extremely hard to come by, to begin to do the job in Zaire. Somehow that training process has got to be so effective that in a short period of time they can do it, and the leadership will go from there. The problem that was faced immediately is the order of selecting, teaching, and baptizing. Since leadership must be maintained, and large numbers cannot be integrated, a very careful selection process initially has to be followed. And what about the others? We had people coming from cities not too far from Kinshasa pleading to have the missionaries come. They had groups of 85, 170 who were meeting regularly on Sunday and studying the Book of Mormon and studying the essentials of the gospel, pleading to have missionaries come to baptize them and to organize a branch of the church. I think one of the lessons they learned in Nigeria was that we must establish solidly the church and develop centers of strength, and then from those centers move out gradually as manpower is maintained, is developed. Manpower and leadership is developed. And that's the rate and patterns of growth. We discovered, for example, in Kinshasa that we mapped the city, we mapped the converts, and we tried to establish circles which would give us an opportunity to provide locations. We developed 9 locations by doing that, and we found 7 buildings to serve those locations. And we found that prior to that time, the church was largely men, because it's men who are educated and men who have the background, men who know the scriptures, the Bible. But as soon as the church was located in an area where the women and children could come, they came in mass, and the wives were baptized and the children were baptized. Now, distance, walking distance, to them was 3 to 5 kilometers. We wouldn't get very far with that in Provo or in Salt Lake, would we? The other great challenge are the economic considerations. Poverty is a major factor. They're well-educated but poor. We have members of the church who are professors in the college. The professors and teachers are paid so poorly that they can do better if they can become a guard. The welfare problems of the developing church could become so difficult. We could expend all of the economic resources of the church just in Zaire and not begin to solve the problem. Billions have been spent in Africa without material, maybe I should say, without increasing the standard of living of the mass of the people. The monies are filtered off by the by graft and government and by the system, so that the standard of living in those countries is actually decreasing. The question of what the church needs essentially is a great issue. We couldn't begin to try to provide the physical facilities that we think are necessary here on the Wasatch Front. We couldn't begin to provide those. Nor can we provide the literature in volume. When you think of visualizing Zaire and then multiplying that by all those numbers, there's got to be a better way. And the final challenge, I think, is the political volatility. The church has been alert, I think, and has utilized its prerogatives to get into various countries. But as you see what's happening in the world, the Lord's doing His part. We've got to become more prepared. We need to mobilize our human and material resources and do all we can to use them more efficiently. But in addition to that, we face the real challenge to identify what the bare, basic essentials are in program and in facilities in order to visualize our potential and challenge to carry the church to these great billions of people in the world. I think the church is seriously studying and trying to face those challenges. Do we need chapels? Do we need Sunday school? Do we need manuals? Essentially, maybe all we're going to need are the scriptures, the facilities to teach the scriptures. Maybe it'll be in homes, in small congregations. Maybe it'll be a very small, modest temple in order that these people may receive the essential ordinances and covenants to be able to enjoy the blessings of the restored gospel. And I leave you that message in the name of Jesus. Amen.
It's an honor for me to be here with you this evening, and I do come representing a group that has a special charge. At Brigham Young University, we represent that arm of the university that has provided now for the past 14 years some technical as well as humanitarian service to members and non-members alike in the areas of Mexico and Central America. I've had the opportunity to participate actively in this program for the past 8 years. I come from a country that has suffered political and economic unrest. I was born and raised in Chile, and you are quite aware of some of the difficulties that we have had to go through in our country. My experience professionally has been primarily in the area of Central America. And the charge that was given to us at the inception of the Benson Institute was to improve the quality of life of people throughout the world by introducing enlightened agricultural practices and improving the quality of the fiber and food for the people of the world. This is what President Benson said at the beginning, back in 1876. We have tried to fulfill that commitment. We have made every effort. It hasn't been easy. Funding is one of the basic problems of organizations like ours. But we have survived, and with the little resources that we have received, we have done what we could to improve the lives of people in areas of Mexico and Central America, Peru and Bolivia, and just recently we have tried to establish some contacts in Chile and Honduras. Just briefly, because I know that I have very little time, to give you an idea of some of the challenges that members and non-members alike, because our work has been ecumenical. We do not look at the religion, although we have asked by leaders of the church to work with members of the church in areas of Guatemala. But just to give you an idea of some of the difficulties and problems that members of the church are facing in these areas, I think I'm going to show it by giving you a couple of examples, three examples. As I walked into this village in the border between Guatemala and Honduras, I was curious to go into a store and to see what was all about. There were quite a few people in there, so I walked in. And as I walked in, I noticed that there was a young man standing in front of the mirror between the two doors going out. And this young man just stood there looking at his own image and very serious in his look, his face, and seemed to be somewhat stunned or surprised. I thought for a minute that he was drunk, but he was not drunk. He walked out and ran across the street and caught his friend, brought him back. And I was following the whole scene. I turned around just to pay attention to what they were doing. And the young man brought his friend back and said, come and see this. I want to show you something. So his friend dragged him by the arm, you know, and brought him back into the store. And he stood in front of the mirror and he says to his friend, "I have never seen a more handsome, good-looking, hard-working young man in my life." And he was serious. I mean, he was not laughing. He was plain serious. So I followed them out there. After he left, you know, his friend started to chuckle and laughed. And we went out, and I followed him, and I was curious to find out what was going on, what was the story. And the other young man told me that this was a Kekchi Indian who has never seen himself in a mirror. That was the first time that he ever stood in front of a mirror. And he was serious in his approach of his outlooks, you know, his personality, his looks. It brought to me the idea of the dignity that these people demand as we work with them in the areas of Central America. I do not pretend here to represent their feelings or their ideas. I come from a different culture. I've worked with them now for the past 4 or 5 years. But I do get a feeling for the understanding of what's happening in Central America and some of the challenges that they face. One of them is in that example of dignity. These people, as expressed before, many of them do not know how to read or write. They have a very limited world, and their challenges are enormous, but they cope, they live, and above all, I've learned that they live the gospel just like any other member of the church. The second example is, we have gone to the area of Momostenango in northern Guatemala. Many of you are familiar with the area. It's an area that has been festered by guerrilla warfare for many, many years. The army has had many incursions against this Marxist and non-Marxist guerrillas. And we ventured because we were asked to go into a community to assist with a fertilizer program that was promoted by another man 14 years earlier and who had had a lot of success. We called the meeting for 9 o'clock in the morning, and because we thought that that would be most appropriate time for the people to come. They have to walk great distances, and in order to participate in the meeting, you have to start a bit early. So we said, well, if we begin at 9, people would have walked by then maybe an hour or two. My most solemn impression was that as we called into the meeting, nearly 70 people showed up, of which about, I would say, 20 were women. And the most impressive group was a group of women that had prepared their children at 3 in the morning and had begun to walk at 4 in the morning to attend the meeting. The women walked through the back. One of them had a baby. I still can see her. She had a baby on her back. And other women were dragging the other children because I'm sure they were quite asleep. Some of them were clinging to their to the mothers and friends. And they walked into the meeting faithfully at 9 o'clock. Now, it really impressed me, and it was hard for me to speak to that group as we began the program to assist them to improve the crops, in the fertilizer program. I learned later on that this woman was a widow, had 4 children, and that the husband had been killed by army soldiers in the area of Petén just a few months earlier. Now that is the type of strength of some of the saints in that area that face challenges that we don't even conceptualize, or we have no idea what they're going through. The next example that I would like to present to you is we established a program almost 2 years ago with non-members of the church in the area of Chiquimula, Guatemala, near the Honduran-El Salvador border. We went to a family that was very much interested, 9 members of the family. They all sleep in one room, women, children, and men in one room. And they had a piece of land that was suitable for some of the cropping, the crops that were providing with beans and corn, which is the staple diet of Central America. And we began working with him and some other members of the community that wanted to participate in the program. We ran into the daughter. We learned that the daughter had finished high school, but we saw that she had really no opportunity in this part of Guatemala to develop as a young woman. The Association of Friends, as we call it, as we organize a farming cooperative, the daughter was called to be, the 16-year-old was called to be the secretary of the Farmers Association, and because she was the only one that could read and write. Most of the men in that association have worked over 34 years as an average in the farms. And yet, the fruits of the labors are not there. The income in this area is $166 a year. Malnutrition in this area is rampant. We witness 2 funerals of babies, which is a very common situation in areas of rural Central America, within a week. These are families that lose their children at a very, very early age. Many deficiencies in vitamin A and some other problems continues to ravage the childhood. This association is now organized. We have now learned that they're willing to continue the program that the Benson Institute has established. And the daughter of the president of the association approached us because she wanted to do something with her life. And so the Benson Institute approached some people in Mexico City at the technological schools, and we put some dollars and pesos together with some friends in Guatemala and some in the United States. And we have now the daughter of that family, the only one that had the opportunity now to attend a technical school. We're very proud of her. She is an excellent student, and we would like to continue to support some of these young people in Central America. These are the kinds of individuals that we have worked with in the past. It's a challenge. Cultural barriers, there are language barriers, and concepts, definitions sometimes become cumbersome for some of the members of this society. Yet we have learned that with a little bit of understanding and patience and love, members of this church can assist and attend some of the problems of other members of the church in other areas of the world. We have had several couples now serve short-term assignments in Central America. We do not call them mission. These are just assignments for service. We would like to invite more people to participate in some of the programs that we have. We have many skills that we're looking for, teachers, mechanics, engineers, agronomists, animal scientists, people in health and nutrition, nurses, doctors that would like to provide service for short term in areas where the institute is working. I believe that members in this country and other countries of the world can make an effort to take the gospel that has been taught to them in the form of service. And I am sure that the lives of many will be blessed by helping to lift the cross of other members of the church in other areas of the world. Thank you.
I'd really like to thank our panelists for their marvelous insights. My mind was racing as I heard the things that they were saying and relating to my experiences that I have had also in third world areas. Now we have about 15 minutes here for questions from the audience. Yes?
I have a question to the doctor, president, or branch president.
Okay.
Is this live?
I have to repeat the question briefly for the recording, and that is, his question is, what scriptural basis is there to prohibit baptism for people because the organization of the church is not ready? Is that close enough?
Okay. I think that's a very good question, and that's a challenge that even with the few couples we had to constantly study and face. But in reality, unless we can bring these people more than baptism, we're not really serving them. That's not going to do it. We've got to be prepared to take them beyond that. And without that back in the bush, they'll drift back to their old ways. And that's happened. So we've had to say, and it's very difficult to say, I'm sorry, but you'll have to wait until we have a center of strength developed in Kinshasa and until there are enough native leaders prepared to begin to take this great message out beyond. That's a very difficult position to take, and I think your position is exactly that some of our missionary couples had a hard time. Why can't we? And those members who had come for those people who had come from those distances would bring rolls of attendance, which would be in the 90th percentile. a dedication, but without some supervision that would be lost. I think it's absolutely essential that we develop centers of strength, we concentrate on developing leadership, and we bring into the church those who can sustain it. It would be very easy to inundate those branches so that the leaders are totally overwhelmed with the responsibilities.
Okay, repeating the question for the tape, what problems do you visualize as mainland China takes over Hong Kong?
Perhaps I'm rather naive, but I have lived in Hong Kong for about 6 years and almost as many years on the mainland. I am concerned about the official policy as we hear it being promulgated from Beijing. Nonetheless, they have promised that Hong Kong will remain Hong Kong. That is a free port, as we have known it, that the social institutions that have been so strong in China, or in Hong Kong, to build it to where it is today, will be respected and will not be destroyed. They have also very specifically stated that religious organizations will be allowed to continue as they are today. I would like to believe that. However, the events in Tiananmen Square last year frightened all of us. As to my own opinion, and this is based on study and experience there, I feel that there will be extreme changes in the government in China over the next 7 years. And I do believe myself that when the Chinese government comes to Hong Kong to take control of that colony, that their attitudes and the people who will come there will be such that the church will be able to continue. I think proselyting will be allowed. I believe that if the time were to come that a temple could be built there, it would be respected in Hong Kong. Now that is perhaps a bit bright considering what they've done in China. But I have heard them promise religious freedom, and despite the political difficulties in Beijing, once you get away from Beijing, the climate is much more friendly to the foreigner. And especially in South China, the churches are open. The government doesn't control them as they did when they first allowed religious freedom following the Cultural Revolution. So based on that, I'm very optimistic. I think that we will see a continuation of what we're doing in Hong Kong even after the 1997 takeover.
Just a short follow-up question.
There's always been a flight for Latter-day Saints. I remember all those young people I helped come here to go to school with promises they would return and help build a church in Hong Kong. Maybe 10% have gone back. I don't think that there is a noticeable increase as we get closer to 1997. And the leadership in Hong Kong is strong. We have a very good organization there.
Okay. How is the principle of tithing taught in countries where people are just surviving?
It's your turn. Excuse me. I think it isn't hard to teach tithing in Zaire, and they do very well. Their income is a pittance, but the percentage of tithe payers is high. What is hard to teach is the principle of fasting when they only struggle to eat one meal a day.
Could I add one thing to that? As we taught tithing in Taiwan when I was there in the early 1970s, I was extremely impressed with the ready receptiveness of the principle. I remember one example of a man who, when he came to his pay tithing shortly after he was baptized, he brought an accounting to us. It was 10% of everything. He had gotten a gift from a friend, and he had asked the friend at which store that gift was purchased, and he went to the store to find out the price and paid 10% of that. But this was always very heartening for me as I saw these new converts almost immediately accept that principle and live it. And it was 10%, and 10%, I remember families in Taiwan those years whose annual income was $60, but they paid their 10%.
We have seen members of the church in Central America develop the pattern of paying in kind, and many of you maybe have seen this. They do bring, they go out there with the children and they count the bags of broccoli. They have gathered. And I saw a bishop teaching his little children to count the bags and then take, you know, whatever corresponds to one-tenth to take it back to the chapel to the bishop. It's a concept that is readily accepted by the poor. I don't know why. That's the way it is, I guess.
Yes. Okay, a question is, how well does the church accept cultural differences with an example of music into the church?
Sports,
etc. Marriage customs, we could... Yeah.
Polygamy, for example, in Zaire, not like...
Polygamy, okay.
Okay, polygamy.
Well, the church does not accept members who are polygamists in Zaire. As far as the culture, we've brought back some tapes of their music. And it's they have some tremendous music. They tend to our hymns sung by them have a different twang. There are some of the customs which I suppose we have. Well, it depends. But by and large, where it's not totally different and would not be applicable, we need to appreciate their traditions and customs.
May I comment briefly also? Your question and asking about polygamy brings back to mind knocking on a door in Hong Kong in 1955, speaking very poor Chinese, but we were able to explain we were Mormons, and the particular person who came to the door knew about the Mormons. And her first comment was, oh, you'll get along great among the Chinese. They believe in polygamy too. And the Chinese did practice polygamy in the last century. It's not practiced generally now. But to answer the question directly, as we lived there, of course, we were constantly concerned that the principles, the gospel principles, did remain pure and were not corrupted by religious beliefs there. And this, of course, was very carefully shepherded. But music, cultural things were brought into the meetings in the church, not to change a sacrament meeting, but in the young people's organizations, the music was very, very well respected and used. Other cultural differences, I found that there was much to respect, and again, we didn't set out to change those, unless they were in direct conflict with religious teachings and beliefs.
Okay, yes.
Strengthen our forces a little bit.
Okay, the question is about the disparity in the number of missionaries between places like South America and Africa. Why does Africa have so few?
In some African countries, they are calling local members as missionaries, and they're serving locally. In Nigeria, they've had relatively, compared to the total number of couples, relatively large numbers of young missionaries called and trained in MTCs and serving. That's true of Zimbabwe as well, and in Ghana. In Zaire, we've adopted and followed to date a little different pattern. We've called the young men who've been in the church hasn't been there long, but who've been elders for a year and who are anxious to serve as missionaries, as district missionaries. By so doing, we've called them to serve maybe two or three parts of days a week. In doing that, we've not needed to clothe them or house them or take them out of their native environment, and yet they have taught under the supervision of couples, so that a couple may supervise two or three sets of missionaries. And right now in Kinshasa, with two couples and nine branches, there's no other way. But we avoid then the problems that I perceive they're facing in other areas where they've taken them out of their native environment, out of their native standard of living, and have put them in a more artificial standard of living, which already from our point of view is pretty low. But when they get through with that experience, where do they go? From there, they would like the church to educate them. They would like the church to do this and that. So in Zaire, at least, we've been experimenting with this particular approach, and it has been very helpful, and I suppose an additional period of time will help to let us know whether that's an effective way to go. We need more couples. We've pleaded for couples. There are a number of new Francophone missions in the world. The number of French-speaking couples are limited, particularly because those who have arrived at retirement age, there was a hiatus of couples in Europe from the beginning of the war when I went home, of about 7 years. We're in that hiatus, so the numbers that are trained, that are available, are limited. And just now, the European stakes and wards are beginning to produce missionaries of their own who will be available and who are starting to go. So for the immediate present, Francophone couples in the world is in extremely short supply.
Thank you.
Yes, they do. And we've been willing to accept couples with only 2 months MTC French, and some of them have done extremely well, because with the native languages, they may need an interpreter anyway. In addition to that, the church has instituted the French pre-training program of 6 months before they go into the MTC, as they had in Spanish, and some couples are beginning to take advantage of that opportunity. Well, I think that's a good question. Africa is, the health problems are difficult. We had in Mauritius, on Mauritius, for example, we had some young missionaries. We had 10 couples over which we presided on the two islands, and we transferred them back and forth. These were selected missionaries sent from the mission field where they had already served a year, from the French-speaking missions in Europe and a few French-speaking or native French missionaries who had begun their service in the United States. They came, and on Mauritius, they got by. Mauritius is third world. The health considerations are not as strict. In Zaire, it would be very difficult, and to try to house them with a standard of living that is required would be extremely expensive. Supervision would be difficult. It, in my opinion, at the present time, it would complicate things.
Okay, one last question.
I would like to know if
is building the centers of strength in Zaire particular to the LDS Church, or do other Christian churches do it also?
It's peculiar to the LDS Church, and peculiar to the LDS Church only very recently. Picture yourself an international missionary going into this great country. What are you going to do? You're going to teach anybody you can. And when you've taught them and feel like they're prepared, you baptize them. Well, that happened. The same thing happened 10 years prior in Nigeria, and the difficulty the church encountered to recover from that and develop solid centers taught the people.